Talk given Friday, 13th February 1981. We saw last time that to talk of karma as retributive justice or as a process of equilibration or to ascribe a very rigid cause and effect mode of karma's working out were all very inadequate presentations. And in fact, retributive justice was a self-contradictory phrase and simply couldn't possibly apply to karma as such. And you may remember that towards the end of the meeting, I mentioned how Aristotle talked of justice. Justice is the practice of virtue towards others. And Plato presented justice as the effective harmony of the whole. When India talks of karma, she means that complete justice is done to each and everybody. People say, these good things have come to you because you were the responsible agent who set going the causes, and now you're reaping the effects. And what troubles and ills come to us is also the retribution for our ill-doing in past lives and so forth. Now we saw that those ideas are remarkably inadequate. And I think it would be worth our while to go somewhat deeply into this, because actually karma has been very little understood by anybody and everybody, more or less. I have never come across a truly satisfactory or near satisfactory and sensible presentation of the teaching of karma. Now, if we take Aristotle's presentation, which is a very good one, with regard to justice, that it is the practice of virtue towards others. And Plato's idea is involved in that, because the practice of virtue towards others leads ultimately to an effective harmony of the whole. Now this is completely borne out and supported and borne out in the teachings of the great founders of the religions. And you remember I quoted from the Sermon on the Mount and the Buddha's teachings with regard to the Brahma Viharas. You remember that statement, monks, even if low down thieves were to carve you limb from limb, and if your minds felt enmity towards them, you are not doers of my teaching, and so forth. You remember, he says that not only with respect to cruelty practiced upon them, murderous cruelty practiced on the monks, but even if harsh words were said to them. So now we must consider, how does karma work so that justice is done, bearing in mind our difficulty involved with our ordinary conceptions of justice. Let us consider, for instance, natural disasters and accidents. People say that anybody who is caught in a natural disaster or an accident, well, that was his karma. Something in the past which brought about this. Just think for a moment. If a war breaks out, terrible devastation takes place, is it possible that everybody who has suffered as a result of the war has done something to deserve specifically that? I'm afraid the chances are desperately against it. Take, for example, earthquakes, volcanoes, floods, forest fires, collisions, and people are killed or maimed. When an earthquake takes place, as that one which took place in Italy recently, and so many hundreds and hundreds of people are killed and suffer terrible sorrow and so forth. What did each and every one of those people, including the children, do or think or feel in some postulated past life which brought about this particular sorrow and pain upon them? It is very, very difficult to, at least for me, it's quite impossible to allocate such and such a result of some postulated ill-doing in a past life. That is, assuming there is anything like a past life, which I positively say there isn't. Now, in addition to that, there are the man-inflicted troubles. Take Hiroshima, for example. One atom bomb killed off 100,000 people straight away. How does one sort of square that with this idea that every one of those people has done something to deserve just that? It's quite unacceptable, really. Take, for instance, now, if in our own day and age a hydrogen bomb is dropped, they say 3 million people will be slain, just wiped out like that. Now, did 3 million people, how was it that they gathered and were present in that particular place in order to receive this kind of punishment for some ill deed in the past? Consider the scale of it. What sort of crime would one have to perpetrate in order to deserve a modern hydrogen bomb upon one? Is it at all sensible to think in those ways? You take the old-fashioned idea that evildoers will have eternal punishment in hell, and the good doers, if the balance is on the credit side for them in their life, will have an eternal heaven for their good doing and their good lives. Is there any limited little human being who can commit a crime or 10 crimes or 50 crimes which could deserve an eternity of hell? You see how ridiculous the idea is. Completely absurd. So, where does our difficulty lie? does not the trouble lie with our concepts of justice? Our idea of justice is the rather absurd one of tit for tat. This particular wrong deserves that particular punishment, like you have in the statute book of human laws. But these concepts change with time. Justice, the whole idea of justice is bound up with our ethics, our ideas of right and wrong. This is right and therefore should be rewarded thus, to this extent and in this manner, punishment is meted out for what is wrong. So you see, this reward-punishment idea is associated with our rather childish ethical feeling of good and evil, that the good deserves some nice things and the evil deserves, wrongdoing deserves those other things. Consider how things have changed as regards conceptions of this sort. Look at the Mosaic law, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, etc. It's given out in full in Exodus chapter 21, and it starts, I think, at verse 24, this particular idea. You see, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot. All this is mentioned as the law for the people. Then in Greece, we had the code which was laid down by the Thesmothete, that is a lawgiver, who was a member of the Athenian Eupatridae, which was the group of archons who were concerned with the law and to administer the law and so forth. Draco's code, which was worked out in 621 BC, was very simple. And it was so simple and so terrible that the word draconian has been derived from it. And his code was death for all offenses, whatever they may have been. Now, a person in India might say, this fellow was put to death for thieving, that fellow for murdering, this fellow for saying boo to the archon, and he was put to death. That was his karma. What an idiotic conception of karma. Consider the time of the Buddha in India. The punishments which were meted out were incredibly savage punishments. If you want to read about them in detail, I will show them to you in the Majjhima Nikaya and in the gradual sayings, the Anguttara Nikaya. They are there in detail. And it's incredible that in India, which in the time of the Buddha, when it was the golden age of the Upanishads and so forth, just a century before the Buddha's birth, that in such an India, in the midst, whilst such great teachers flourished, and a very sophisticated civilization flourished, that they should have such barbarous and savage punishments and so forth. And it was all put down, classed under the word karma. That was his karma for doing this, that, and the other. Two centuries later, in Kautilya's Arthashastra, I've got the complete translation of that work with me here, the punishments that were meted out were only slightly less barbaric than in the time of the Buddha. And in China, again, we have records of the most barbarous, savage punishments. It's incredible that a civilization like China's, which produced such wonderful art and beautiful things and so forth, should have this other side, this utterly savage and barbarous side. And in fact, China's history has really been written in red, written in blood, throughout the centuries, starting long before India. There are records of the first great kings, Yao and Shun and all that dynasty. They start at 2300 BC. And yet, this great civilization, as we call it, had all this sort of thing. Take Europe, Roman law. Roman law was pretty savage, where justice, the meeting out of punishments was concerned in the name of justice. Then again, if you take Europe and England right up to the end of the 19th century, the law was very, very harsh, very cruel. Children were hanged for stealing bread. And there was terrible poverty, terrible difficulty. If one reads the history of Europe, one can hardly keep a dry eye. It's a terrible history of cruelty and horror. Prostitutes and vagrant women were publicly flogged. So were Quakers, the women particularly, more so than the men. There are awful records of all this kind of thing. Now you can't say that was their karma. At least I will never say that that was their karma. It's utterly nonsensical. Consider the Inquisition. And so forth. In our own day, look at the contrast between Islamic law and our laws. There's an enormous contrast. And the word karma cannot be applied to them. How did vengeance and cruelty come into justice in practice? Now there, we must bear in mind that throughout the ages, the relationship between human beings has been one of reaction in answer to an action, of reaction, a tit-for-tat idea, not a true human response. Now this is the key point. Not a true human response. And as you have so often heard, the word human means blissful creator. The reactions express the primitive passions of undeveloped persons, of subhumans. These reactions express the hates and the fears of human beings. But where nomadic people live, justice has to be stern. That is to say, the law has to be stern. Because unless with nomadic tribes there is complete absolute obedience and loyalty to the chief, the nomadic tribe was always in danger of being decimated by other tribes around it. So, the ruler had to rule with a very, very strict hand altogether. And so, their code of justice, what they call justice, was very brutal, and it had to be that for the sake of their survival. Now, consider another point. Has not our inherent pleasure-pain mechanism, which enables the body to preserve itself safely in a world of movement and so on, has not our inherent pleasure-pain mechanism dominantly influenced our ideas of justice? Hence the reward-punishment idea comes in. Pain-pleasure. Pain for wrongdoing, pleasure, something acceptable, agreeable for good doing. Or it may be incentive deterrent. The incentive deterrent idea has invaded our systems of justice. There is another point we have to bear in mind. All these evil things which have come into the administration of justice and which have been attributed to the karmic law, quite falsely, all these have come into being considerably through our frustrations in the pursuit of desire, of pleasure, ambition, self-expression, as we call it, and so on. If we are frustrated, then the violence is roused up in us. Violence, hate, fear, which moves us to hurt or to destroy that which stands in our way and opposes us. And also the state of extraordinary ignorance. People just didn't know, didn't understand at all. They had no vision of what was the purpose of our existence, in which way our life was developing and towards what sort of fruition for the human race. The ignorance of all that, coupled with all these elements at play, brought about these awful things in the name of justice. Even philosophers, particularly philosophers like Hegel and Fichte and various others, they too openly upheld the ruthless extermination of whatever stood in the way of the ego, the big ego, who had ability, who had will, determination, ambition. If anything stood in the way of that, he had the right to steamroller it. Even great intellects, so close to our own age as the 18th and 19th centuries, produced that sort of philosophy. We can just see how backward human beings have been and still are. But through the centuries, there have been the few realized human beings who had fulfilled the purpose of their existence and who lived in accord with that vision of divinity itself. And they saw clearly that the purpose of justice was not to reward or punish what is called, accepted as good or evil, but to heal, to release all human beings, good doers and evil doers alike. This is the important point. to release all human beings into the state of holiness, of wholeness, of true health. Consider the words of Jesus. Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. That is a terrific thing to say, isn't it? I mean, supposing I were to go to a public meeting and say, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. People say, what's that lunatic talking about? Like the Buddha, Zarathustra, Krishna, and all the truly great spiritual teachers, Jesus bent all his energy towards helping all people to grow towards their perfection, towards the realization of their potential divinity. I'm not using the word divinity as equivalent to God in the petty anthropomorphic sense, but divinity in the real sense, in the sense in which, for instance, Mahayana Buddhism presents it. And to this end, instead of punishing or rewarding anyone, Jesus gave his own life as a ransom for the many, and himself suffered crucifixion to redeem all mankind. Now, many people rebel against this idea. They don't like it. They don't want somebody to be a ransom for themselves. But they don't understand what that really means. If there is a human being who has trod the way and reached the goal, the end point, the complete realization of his true and full humanity, then because he is completely interrelated and constantly interacting with all the world around him, he will necessarily suffer because of the wrongdoing of others around him. But they will always have the good effect of his constant right doing. So, in his right doing, he gives his life all the time. He's pouring out his life energy. And in doing that, he's giving his life as a ransom for the many. Is that clear or not clear?
I misunderstood it, because I always, although one knows the word, he gave his life, many, I took it that meant he gave up his life. In other words, he died.
Oh, yes, yes. But now, wait a minute, I haven't quite finished. Yes. For the many. And himself suffered crucifixion to redeem the world of its sinful state. Justice. This was a manifestation of divine justice. The practice of virtue towards others. Living in such a way as to bring about the effective harmony of the whole. This is justice in the big sense. And this is how true justice works. It includes martyrdom. It includes suffering for the wrongdoings of the wrongdoer by the right doer. Now look, supposing any and every one of you has a vision and an understanding and has the ability and the capacity to express that perfectly and fully in our world as it is, you will be completely out of step with the world as it is. The outside world will feel uncomfortable. They don't want you. They'd rather have fellows like themselves enjoying the ninth pint of beer. Don't you see? They will not regard you as a friend. They will be against you. And in their being against you, they will some way or other harm you, hurt you, put you down, get rid of you. Haven't they done that throughout the world's history? Who murdered Socrates? Poisoned him. Gave him the poison from which he died. Who crucified Al-Hallaj? The one who was able to say quite truthfully, An Al-Haq, I am one of the signs of divinity. Consider all the martyrs. Jesus we have already mentioned. The Buddha was the only one who didn't die a violent death. Zarathustra was murdered in the temple as he was praying at the age of 77. Sri Krishna, and this is of course explained as a karmic working out of a past situation. A hunter shot an arrow the hunter intended to shoot the arrow at the animal he was hunting. Something went wrong and the arrow slew Sri Krishna. You see? It's very interesting. Muhammad died in bed comfortably. But all the other great teachers suffered a fate like that. Moses, great teacher that he was, and a truly perfected one, there's ample evidence of that in the Old Testament. Whenever you read in the Old Testament, went up into the Mount of the Lord and spoke face to face with the Lord as a friend to a friend. Those are the sort of expressions which tell us something about their real state. You take Enoch, for instance, in Genesis, in the third, fifth chapter of Genesis, I think, where the genealogy is given from Adam downwards, Adam through Seth and the others to Enoch. Enoch was the seventh one, you see. And Enoch walked with God. And Enoch was not, for God took him. The meaning of that is that Enoch was one of those remarkable people who realized the ultimate, complete meditative state. The state which the Catholic mystics call the Unio Mystica, which we in India call Samadhi, you see, which in Buddhist terms is called the cessation, which in the Upanishadic terms is called the entry into the Turiya state. The Turiya state, you see. That's the meaning of these things. So now, this is the way justice works, actually. That which heals, not counteracts. Punishment and reward are mere counteraction, or palliatives as the case may be. And they just leave us in the state, in the dualistic state, and do not enable us to be released from the conflict and the misery of dualism, thou and I, the self and the not self, and the eternal conflict as long as we are conscious in that manner. So the great teachers always gave the transcendental answer to these questions. And this is the real meaning of karma, because karma, derived from kri, the root kri, means to create. It stands for that creative action by the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy acting in eternity. this phrase is getting sort of stabilized now. It is creative action by the ultimate in eternity. That is the fundamental meaning of karma. And that activity works in a manner which is calculated. I mean, there is no calculator behind it. It naturally and spontaneously works like that to bring all manifestation towards its ultimate fruition, so that the rose will be the perfect rose, and the oak tree the perfect oak tree, and the tiger the perfect tiger, the beast of prey will be the perfect beast of prey, and so on. Now you see that in this sort of process, pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow are all included in the process, in the karmic process. But this inclusion in the karmic process doesn't remain as an endless process which has the duals in conflict with each other. Not at all. The duals get transcended, and they come to their fruition as the primordial unity, the oneness of the universe. Now think, supposing your consciousness could become of such a nature that it included the total universal process. Which part of it are you going to throw out? If your consciousness was able to become that sort, it would be totally accepting. It would be totally containing in the bosom of the Father, to use a theistic phrase. Totally containing. And in the Buddhist teachings of the Brahma Viharas, you know, the divine residences as they are called, and that is the teaching which is given out most frequently when some person asks the Buddha to show the way to union with Brahma, the creator God, the creative power, the ultimate creative power. That is what Brahma stands for, you see. Then he gives out this teaching of the Brahma Vihara, to first of all let the mind be purified of all hindrances, all lustful thoughts and feelings, whether for sex or power or wealth or whatever it is, all malevolence and ill will, all worry and flurry, all sloth and torpor, and all vichikicca, doubt. Lovely onomatopoeic word, vichikicca. You see? When the mind is calm, then suffuse your friend, your teacher, first of all, your friend, the one who is in suffering, and so on, with loving kindness, metta. It's very funny. In the early years, when the Buddhist society sort of used to have some talks from me, lectures at Caxton Hall and so forth, and afterwards people would write letters of thanks, and they would address me, "Dear Mr. Metta, M-E-T-T-A. You see, with loving kindness. And not only what is around you, but the entire world, suffuse it with loving kindness. And then suffuse the entire world in that same manner with compassion, karuna. Karuna, compassion, you must translate compassion in its real sense. Passion passion means to your suffering with another's suffering. That is what passion means. Compassion is that suffering with another's suffering, because you are not really separate from him, with complete loving kindness at the same time towards that person, and so on. Now you will see that this is the power, this is the kind of power that really brings about justice. And this is the real karmic process. The whole karmic process is working towards that. Insofar as you or I, as a self-conscious individual, is enslaved by my separativeness, by my isolativeness, I will do this, that, or the other against nature's laws. And that will naturally bring upon me the consequence in terms of suffering, won't it? There is it slipped out of my mind. So now, karma and justice, karma which is divine justice, brings about complete healing, releases one into the holy state in which there is neither pleasure nor pain, neither joy nor sorrow, but there is present only the great peace, the pure bliss. Bliss has nothing to do with what we understand by happiness and joy and pleasure. Nothing to do with that. It is something you have to experience in the deeps of consciousness. And the name given to that in India was Ananda. Ananda is that bliss. It is the sublime, unoriginated Nirvana. Now, consciousness is a very important point in all this. One has to become conscious of this. If you read or hear these things, or if you think in these ways merely, all thinking is a string of words, a putting together of concepts and words which represent those concepts and their meanings. That is our ordinary thinking, you see. If it is a case of merely listening and reading and thinking these things, nothing will happen. To be conscious of something is to be completely aware of it and be free of knowing it with your brain. If you are really conscious of love, what happens is that you are love itself, love embodied. But the brain won't know it. Your own brain won't know it. All your feeling, thinking, speaking, and doing will express love. So, if one is truly conscious of anything, one knows it. I'm sorry, I have to use the forbidden word. One knows it with a knowing that transcends ordinary knowing. You are it. It is the knowing by being it. And that is the meaning of transcendence. You see, how and why did the karmic process start off at all? The primordial creative energy Brahman, God, the unborn, the unoriginated, the unmade, the unformed, desiring to know itself, constricted itself and made two thereby. I and the manifestation of me. And the Lord God looked into the manifestation to discover himself. You will find this in the depths of Hindu, Buddhist, Judaic, Kabbalistic, Christian, and various teachings like that. Not in the Gospels, not in the New Testament. There are indications in the Old Testament. There are suggestions. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that it was good. He was seeing himself. You consider how and why you strive to do this, that, or the other. Make an effort and do it. You discover yourself. This is the separate self. I am I. But when one has freed oneself of the illusion of the separate I as such, and really, really becomes conscious, begins to become conscious of the totality, the one total reality of transcendence, and the sense of transcendence wakes up in you, then something very different happens. Divine justice comes into play. And the karmic process is the process which is the creative process that leads you into the state of complete holiness.